Hi, I'm Katie Harris. I'm a Senior Associate Solicitor in Boyes Turner's employment team. This series is going to be looking at the different elements of corporate support work that we do as employment lawyers. In our last episode, we looked more closely at the employment aspects of asset and share purchases. You'll remember that the key difference between these two types of acquisition from an employment perspective was the application of a piece of legislation called the Transfer of Undertakings Protection of Employment Regulations 2006, otherwise known as TUPE. TUPE applies to asset sales, but in most cases will not apply to a share sale. In this episode, we're going to focus in on TUPE, how it operates, and consider some of the difficulties and challenges it can pose, both operationally and commercially, when dealing with an asset sale. To help explain more, I've been having a chat with Natalie Wood, Associate Solicitor in our employment team. I started by asking her what TUPE is and what it does.
TUPE has been in force in its current form since April 2006. It implements a piece of European legislation known as the Acquired Rights Directive. And the purpose of TUPE is to protect employees where the business or part of a business in which they work is sold or transferred.
So that would be, as we discussed in the last podcast, via an asset sale, most commonly.
Exactly.
So just in expanding on that in broad terms, when does it apply then?
So in high level terms, there are different types of TUPE, a business transfer and a service provision change. A business transfer takes place when there is the transfer of an economic entity that's situated in the UK immediately prior to the transfer. In order for TUPE to apply, that economic entity must retain its identity after the transfer.
So what does that look like in practice then, Natalie? Are you able to give an example of that? Because that all sounds quite complicated.
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, a good example of a business transfer was the sale of part of a motorbike business that I worked on recently. The motorbike business had two parts to it, a service centre and a sales centre. The sales part of the business sold motorbikes and motorbike parts, and the service side, obviously, undertook servicing and repairs. So let's call the business Motorbike Co. The buyer bought the servicing part of the business and they acquired all of the equipment used, together with things like the client list, existing customers and supplier contracts, and obviously as well the right to receive payment for services already undertaken. The intention was for the servicing side of the business to carry on as normal after the acquisition, but to run from a different location and under a new name. So Motorbike Co. would continue to exist, but would only operate as a sales business. The acquisition of the service side of the business was a business transfer under TUPE. The nature of the assets that were acquired meant there was a clear and identifiable economic entity, a servicing business, that continued to function in the same way after the transfer and retained its identity as a servicing business despite operating from a different location and under a different name.
So just to stop you there then, because we've used this analogy, I think, in the last podcast, which I loved, and I think it was one you introduced, which was this concept of a box of biscuits. So in this case, in this example, you know, we had this company Motorbike Co. Motorbike Co. is the box. And the biscuits inside it, I suppose, would have been the servicing business and all the assets and things that went along with that, and the sales centre, and again, all the sort of assets, so the stock and the customer list and things like that that went along with it. And so in this example, the buyer has bought all of the sales side. So they've bought all of the biscuits, so the assets relating to that part of the business. And that's continued to function in the same way. And so that's then a business transfer. So that's TUPE. That's when TUPE applies.
Yes, exactly.
Perfect. So what's the example of a service provision change? And that's the other sort of transfer mm-hmm. that you mentioned.
An example in that context could be where a company outsources its IT support services to a third-party contractor. And we do tend to see that kind of thing a fair amount. And this would likely constitute a TUPE transfer under the SPC provisions. And any employees who were assigned to carry out IT support services for the company would then transfer to the third party contractor under TUPE.
Right. But that's not sort of a corporate acquisition. So that's not the buying or the sale of a business.
No, quite.
That's kind of like outsource services type situation is usually when service provision changes would apply.
Yeah, where a service stops being provided by one service provider and then is instead carried out by another. So when GP applies, it will automatically transfer to the buyer all employees that are working in the business that's being transferred, together with their contracts of employment, with some limited exceptions. It also transfers to the buyer liability in respect of employees dismissed by the seller in advance of the transfer. But the reason for that dismissal was the transfer. It will also render any dismissal automatically unfair where the reason for it is related to the transfer, unless there is an economic, technical, or organizational reason entailing changes in the workforce. And it also transfers any trade union recognition in respect to the transferred employees to the buyer, transfers any collective agreements with trade unions applicable to the transferred employees. It also prohibits any change to terms and conditions of employment of those transferring employees when those changes are made because of the transfer. And again, unless there is an ETO reason, so that's our economic, technical, or organizational reason for the change, requires the provision of information to, and in some cases, consultation with appropriate representatives of affected employees. And finally, when GP applies, it also requires supply of a set of specific statutory information about those transferring employees, which we refer to as employee liability information.
So that's a lot. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, when we're dealing with asset purchases from an employment perspective, things can get quite tricky. And so I know a lot of clients, you know, would be wondering this, you know, given that we've got all of this kind of fairly onerous obligations and liabilities that perhaps arise out of GP, can we get a contract out of it? Is there a way of just, you know, drafting into the terms a clause which says, you know, GP doesn't apply to this? I mean, is it possible to contract out of these liabilities at all?
Unfortunately, it's not possible to contract out of GP. It does apply automatically by operation of law where certain conditions are met. And unfortunately, whether the buyer or seller wants it to. But in terms of the liability side of it, we do tend to see parties dealing with that aspect in the asset purchase agreement.
Okay, so we can't prevent GP from applying, but what we could potentially do is insert some clauses or terms into
the
purchase agreement to deal with the you know, financial liabilities and what that could arise out of that. Got you. So taking us into account then, you know, how do we identify whether GP applies to a particular asset purchase or not?
Well, it's a fairly complicated question to answer on a case-by-case basis, and it ultimately requires an analysis of many different elements, including the nature of the assets being acquired, the intention of the buyer post-acquisition, such as whether the business will continue to function in the same way after the transfer. Because of the difficulty in identifying whether GP applies, together with the significant risks of non-compliance, most buyers and sellers tend to work on the assumption that it will apply unless there is a very clear and strong argument that it won't apply. For example, if only discrete assets are being acquired that could not constitute a business. For example, if a food delivery business is buying cars from a taxi service company.
We've said quite a bit that GP only applies to asset purchases, and it doesn't apply to the sale of shares. And this is because there's no business transfer when we're acquiring the shares. The business is kind of staying where it is, so that all of the biscuits are staying within the box. But are there any circumstances in which that might not be the case? So where we might have a share acquisition, but GP applies. Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So if an asset transfer is carried out prior to a share sale, or if there is an intragroup asset transfer post-acquisition, which we tend to see quite a lot. So this is where the assets are transferred to another group company after the acquisition. Or if there is a post-share sale integration of the business into the wider organisation. So that could happen where, for example, a parent company takes over the day-to-day running of its subsidiary businesses to a significant degree. Again, a detailed discussion of these types of cheapy transfers is outside the scope of this podcast, other than to say that buyers and sellers need to be alive to the possibility that a cheapy may still occur, even if there is just a share sale.
Yeah. And we've come across this in practice a few times. I mean, you just sort of mentioned that. Are you able to give kind of a practical example of you know, one that we've worked on recently to illustrate that point?
Yeah, of course. So there was a transaction sort of in the last 12 months where there was a plan post acquisition to integrate the business and assets of the target company into the buyer's existing group structure. And the transfer of the business and assets were due to take place gradually over sort of the next 6 to 12 months period following completion. And although this future cheapie didn't directly impact the share acquisition itself, it was something that has to be borne in mind when considering how to deal with the existing management team, because many of them were due to move on to new fixed term employment contracts following completion, which were due to expire on or around the potential cheapie date, which created a potential risk of automatic unfair dismissals, which needed to be planned for and mitigated.
So, you know, so in other words, even though we might be dealing with what looks like a simple share sale, it's really important to understand the future intention that the buyer has in respect to that business, just in case something like a cheapie might apply further along, because that then can impact perhaps the advice that we're giving on the share sale and particularly with the future plans with the employees.
Exactly.
So working on the assumption that cheapie will apply to an asset purchase then, what are the implications of this? And I know we sort of touched on them in kind of high level summary, but going into a bit more detail on that.
Yeah, well, first and foremost is the obligation to inform and also in many cases consult with employee representatives. So liability for failing to comply with these obligations can result in awards for up to 13 weeks uncapped pay for each employee. So it could be potentially substantial risk there. And the requirement to inform and consult is something which must be borne in mind when planning deal timescales, since consultation, if it's required, must be completed in good time before the relevant transfer date.
So when we're talking about the obligation to inform and consult, what is that exactly?
It's the obligation on the employer of any affected employees to provide a certain set of statutory information to representatives of those employees, which is fairly prescriptive and includes information about the fact and date of the proposed transfer, the reasons for it, the legal and economic and social implications of it, and also whether any measures might be taken in relation to affected employees in connection with that transfer.
Okay, and just to be clear, this obligation to provide information, or that information you've described, that happens in every case where there is a cheapie transfer. Because I know before we sort of said, you know, there is a separate obligation to inform and a separate obligation to consult. The obligation to inform always arises. The obligation to consult only arises in certain
cases, yeah.
Which we'll talk about in a minute. Okay, so looking at the obligation to inform and provide that set of statutory information, are there any particular pitfalls that, you know, employers might make at this stage?
Employers tend to overlook what we mean by affected employees. So it doesn't just mean those that are due to transfer, but it can also mean those whose jobs could be affected in some way by the transfer. So right. If the buyer's existing employees could be affected, if their roles or reporting structures are changed to accommodate new transferring employees, that is something that they would need to be informed about.
Right. So it's just so it's important for both buyers and sellers to identify who are the affected employees quite early on then.
Yeah.
And that could be wider than simply that group of employees who are transferring, depending on the impact of that transfer.
Yeah.
Got you. So going back to that requirement to consult, in what circumstances does that requirement to consult arise?
Well, only if the buyer or seller anticipates taking measures in relation to affected employees.
Right. What are measures then?
Any action, step, or arrangement that has an effect on the employees. So it could even be a minor administrative change. A common one we tend to come across, and I know we have on lots of transactions we've worked on together, but is change to payroll date. you know, even if by a week or so, you know, that is still a measure. To add to that, when consultation is required, it has to take place long enough before a relevant transfer for a meaningful consultation to take place.
That's really
This is deliberately vague. Yeah, absolutely. So what is long enough will depend on the subject matter of the consultation. There must be a clear dialogue, and consultation must also be carried out with a view to seeking the employee's agreement to the measure being proposed. There has to be sufficient time for the employer to explain the reasons for the proposals, receive employee feedback, and consider that feedback, often a point which is not complied with, and also then to provide a response to that. Obviously, a more minor change, so going back to our payroll date example, that is unlikely to prove that contentious, and any concerns are likely to be dealt with fairly easily. Whereas measures which include more substantial changes to terms of employment and or proposed terminations will require significant consultation, which could take weeks, potentially months, if not longer, to reach a conclusion.
And this is a really important point, isn't it? Because, you know, deals that we work on, you know, are often having to work to very sort of specific timelines for commercial reasons. And so, you know, identifying early on whether or not consultation is going to be required, so whether or not the buyer is going to be taking any measures, and also what the extent of those measures are, is really important. Because, you know, if we need to, for commercial reasons, you know, the pressure is on to complete a transaction within a month, but actually the reality is we're planning to make substantial changes to, you know, a large group of employees, and we need to enter into consultation. That consultation process could take 2 or 3 months to do properly. So then we've got a deal timeframe problem. So on that note, how should employers go about consulting with employees or employee representatives?
So consultation has to be with employee representatives unless there is an existing body already in place, or such as a recognised trade union, or if the employer is a micro employer, meaning they've got fewer than 10 employees, then representatives have to be elected through an election process before information and consultation can even commence. So as you touched on earlier, Katie, this can add considerably to the deal timeline. While the length of the process will depend on the size of the employer and number of employees involved, in most cases, an election process can be carried out within 2 weeks to a month, and then the consultation process will normally take another month from there. However, with more complex or contentious cases, it can take significantly longer than this and can take many months to complete properly.
So presumably that can be, you know, really problematic. We've already got the time that would be needed to consult. And if we're also having to add on to that the time that we may need to undertake an election process, that can be quite tricky when things get a bit time pressured. You know, are there any other reasons why it can be quite problematic to have to sort of go through these steps so far in advance before we might want a deal to complete?
Yeah, so confidentiality is kind of a key one there. So it's fairly common for parties of an acquisition to want to maintain confidentiality around the deal for as long as possible. So there can often be a reluctance to engage in consultation before the deal is at kind of more of an advanced stage. Mm-hmm. This could also be for commercial reasons, because, you know, the employers might not want to unsettle the workforce, which, you know, often these things can.
Is there a way around this? Can buyers and sellers get out of the obligation to inform and consult in any way?
Well, there is an exception to the requirements to inform and consult where there are special circumstances which render it not reasonably practicable for the employer to comply with this obligation. This isn't an absolute excuse, as the employer must still take whatever reasonable steps that it can to comply in circumstances.
And it's not easy for an employer to establish a special circumstances defence, is it?
No, absolutely not. The employer must be able to prove that it was constrained by some unexpected, sudden or unforeseen event or occurrence beyond its control, and which was out of the ordinary run of commercial or financial events.
And we had an example recently where we considered if a special circumstance exception would apply. What was that?
So in that circumstance, receivership and liquidation.
And you would have thought that a receivership and a liquidation could potentially amount to special circumstances. Can it?
If sudden and unexpected, yes. But if it's something the employer should have seen coming, then it can be a little bit more murky to establish a special circumstances defence.
Okay. And I think in the case that we worked on, I think we decided that probably a special circumstance defence might possibly be something we could use, but it was certainly not something we could rely on. And actually, even if we did have a special circumstances defence, we would still have to show that we've taken whatever steps we could with the time that we had to undertake that consultation.
Where there are a small number of employees transferring or in the seller's business, there are ways in which the requirement to elect employee representatives can be reduced or avoided. This can help to significantly reduce the overall length of the information and consultation process and its impact on the deal timetable.
Yeah, and obviously, if the buyer and seller don't envisage taking any measures at all in related to any affected employees, then the only thing that they need to do is to provide that information and they can dispense with consultation altogether. So looking at, again, the obligation to carry out this consultation, who has that legal responsibility?
It's the employer of the affected employees. In most cases, the responsibility will sit with the seller as the employer of the transferring employees. The buyer's only obligation is to inform the seller of any measures it intends to take in relation to the transferring employees. However, because liability under TUPE is joint and several, meaning both the buyer and seller can be liable for any failures, the buyer may want to have some involvement in the consultation process to make sure it's carried out properly.
Yeah, and that's also a good idea from an employee relations perspective as well, isn't it? Because if you've got employees who are a bit worried about, the fact that their employer or their employment's about to transfer, it can often help them to meet the new employer, which can be quite reassuring and help with a smooth transition.
Yes, exactly.
And over what period of time does consultation normally take place? I mean, this is probably the golden question. I think it's one that we get asked by clients quite a lot, isn't it? Particularly when we're under pressure to complete within a certain time frame.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's very understandable given the clear 30 or 45 day timescales required under collective redundancy consultations. But under TUPE, there is no set time. The only requirement is that it takes place long enough before completion to enable a consultation to take place. Obviously, if there is no requirement for consultation because there'll be no measures, then in theory, the information can be given at any point up to the date of completion. It's therefore crucial to be able to identify early on whether the buyer will need to take any measures in relation to those transferring employees, as this can have such a big impact on deal timeframes if consultation is required. And also the extent of that consultation will dictate the length of the process.
Are there any other TUPE complications that employers, need to be aware of, or that parties to an acquisition need to be aware of? And we've talked about obviously information consultation, which is, can be difficult and onerous. Are there any other things that might be impactful on an acquisition?
Well, the primary concern is really that TUPE is there to protect employment. So it imposes certain restrictions on the extent to which employees can be dismissed or their contracts changed in the context of a TUPE transfer. And so dismissals that are made before or even after the transfer that occur because of it will be automatically unfair unless there is an economic, technical or organisational reason for that dismissal that entailed changes in the workforce. In most cases, this restriction won't cause too many issues in the context of an acquisition, as most dismissals will be by reason of redundancy, which would potentially constitute an economic, technical or organisational reason and then potentially would be permissible.
So this is all very difficult for mostly probably for a buyer of the business who might well want to make changes to the workforce once they've acquired the business. But there are certainly things that can be done to address that risk.
Absolutely, yes.
So, we talked about this kind of economic, technical and organisational reason, which is one way a buyer could, perhaps make changes to contractual terms, or it could terminate contracts of employment if needed to.
Yeah. So, I mean, a buyer could validly make these changes if they can demonstrate they've got an ETO reason for the change.
Or, of course, if they had a reason for making contractual changes that was absolutely nothing to do with TUPE transfer. Again, that's something that could potentially be done, isn't it?
Yeah.
So with CHEEPE then, if we've got liability that arises under CHEEPE, perhaps because we've changed terms of conditions or we've terminated employment, we failed to inform or consult, who bears the liability for that? Is it the buyer or the seller?
So both can be liable. So the buyer and seller can be jointly and severally liable for any failures to inform and consult. So the buyer can be liable for failures caused by the seller and vice versa. In addition, as all rights, duties and liabilities in relation to the transferring employees transfer automatically to the buyer on completion, the buyer can find themselves liable for any pre-completion acts or failings of the sellers, such as pre-completion dismissals or resignations.
So it's fair to say that both sellers and buyers can be at risk of claims in a CHEEPE situation. So how do we deal with these risks?
Well, typically, parties can seek to agree indemnities in the asset purchase agreement with the aim of apportioning these risks. So the seller and buyer will both agree to indemnify the other in relation to any respective failure by them to comply with CHEEPE information and consultation obligations. And the buyer will want to seek indemnification for any pre-completion dismissals or any other failures for which it could be liable. The buyer will also want to seek certainty over what rights and liabilities will be passing to it under CHEEPE and in respect of which employees. Indemnities and warranties are frequently used to provide certainty for the buyer, such as a warranty that the identity of all transferring employees has been provided, backed up by an indemnity in relation to any individuals who transfer to the buyer unexpectedly.
So that's all been really, really interesting. Obviously, CHEEPE is an incredibly complex large area to talk about. There are some changes, aren't there, on the horizon, Natalie?
Yeah, so one of those changes is to remove the requirement for employers to elect employee representatives. So for the purposes of CHEEPE consultations for businesses with fewer than 50 employees, that irrespective of the size of the transfer, and for businesses of any size where the transfer involves the transfer of fewer than 10 employees. And in these situations, businesses would be able to consult directly with employees, provided, of course, that there are no existing employee representatives in place.
That would be a massive help, though, wouldn't it? Because we talked about the probably one of the biggest complications of CHEEPE, aside from the restrictions around what we can do with employees, is this impact potentially on deal timeframes. And, the election or having to go through an election process is a pretty substantial impact. So if that can be removed in any way, that's helpful. I think that kind of wraps up a closer look at CHEEPE. Thank you very much, Natalie. That has been really informative.
Absolute pleasure.
That was Natalie Wood, Associate Solicitor in our employment team. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about the due diligence process, and we're going to cover areas which I think will be of real benefit to HR people or managers. Whether you're buying or selling a business, this will give some idea of how to get your ducks in a row, the sorts of things that you might get asked, and how to get everything prepared so that you're ready for that process. Just subscribe or follow the podcast and you will be able to listen to the episode as soon as it is available. Thanks and goodbye.